From WBUR and NPR, I'm Don Gagne.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden meets with his COVID-19 advisors today as cases rise in all 50 states, particularly among the unvaccinated.
In a news conference last night, Biden said sending military troops to stabilize the government in Haiti is not on his agenda, and he addressed the largest anti-government protests in decades in Cuba.
Cuba is unfortunately a failed state in repressing their citizens. There are a number of things that we would consider doing to help the people of Cuba, but it would require a different circumstance or a guarantee that they would not be taken advantage of by the government.
And let's start right there with our politics roundtable. Yamiche Alcindor is White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and moderator of Washington Week. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you. We're also glad to have Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. Scott, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you.
All right. And last night, President Biden talked about allowing people once again to send remittances or money to their relatives in Cuba. But he said, not now, because he's concerned that the government might confiscate the money, which is what we just heard him say there in the introduction. So what else is the White House considering here on Cuba, Scott?
Well, what they're President Biden and Democrats are under a lot of pressure from Republicans, including the governor down in Florida, Ron DeSantis, who is calling on the Democrats to help establish and restore stable internet connections in Cuba, which obviously would help some of the demonstrators communicate better on social media and for Cubans in general to receive, you know, up-to-date news and information about what's happening around the island. Now, Biden said just yesterday that he's open to helping restore this internet, but he provided few details. And so, you know, he has said on the remittances question, he has said, well, we don't want to allow remittances back to Cuba for Americans to send money into Cuba because we believe that that money would be confiscated. But it's really unclear what exactly the United States can do at this point other than to continue to show support for some of these democracy protesters in Cuba.
Yamiche, what do you think? I mean, this is the first time in a while that a U.S. president has seen so much instability in a region that is so very close to home. So, you know, what is at stake in your mind for Joe Biden as he does consider the response to the twin crises in Cuba and also in Haiti?
Well, there's a lot at stake in terms of politically. These are two countries that have large bases in the United States. You have, of course, a large diaspora in the United States among Haitian Americans in Miami, Cuban Americans in Miami, who have traditionally and pretty historically have voted for Republicans. And what you see here is really President Biden trying to thread this needle of paying attention to Latin America. But also when you talk to White House officials, it's very clear that he was very much focused on China and Russia and that this wasn't a region that was a top priority for him. It wasn't a region that he was talking about a lot. I did a lot of reporting talking to Haitian Americans and Haitians before the assassination of President Jovenel Moise, who were openly saying that they were disappointed in President Biden, feeling as though he was breaking a promise to do more for Haiti in particular. So this is a moment where President Biden, as he's dealing with Afghanistan and as he's dealing with the coronavirus pandemic and voting and all these other things, he now has this extra thing that he has to deal with. And that is, of course, the crises that we've been talking about in Latin America. So he's going to just have to figure out what can he do, what diplomatically can he do to figure these issues out.
Okay, guys, it's Infrastructure Week, and it really does seem to be Infrastructure Week this time. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he wants a test vote next Wednesday on a bipartisan plan to spend more than $1 trillion on traditional infrastructure, roads, bridges, broadband, that sort of thing. Texas Republican John Cornyn criticized the timing of the vote because the bill isn't even written yet.
As I see it, our friends on the other side have made it even more difficult to convince our colleagues, let alone the American people, that this type of spending is necessary.
Okay, Scott, we'll start with you. Why are Democrats in such a rush to get this voted on next week?
Well, because this thing has been negotiated and negotiated endlessly for months and months. And Chuck Schumer wants to see some sort of resolution. And so he is issuing a threat to Republicans that if you guys really are serious about infrastructure and you've announced that you have a bipartisan deal on a framework, then let's see the goods. And so he has set up this test vote for Wednesday, even though we have not even seen the legislative text of the bill. There are some last minute 11th hour issues that have come up having to do with how you pay for the infrastructure. One provision that's creating a big headache right now is this pay for that would raise $100 billion by allowing the IRS to go after tax cheats. And Republicans are now balking at this proposal and haven't come up with a solution of how to backfill that $100 billion. And so there's a lot of moving parts to this. But basically, we should know by the middle of next week whether or not Democrats can bring across 10 Republicans needed to break a Republican filibuster and really see if this thing's going to happen.
And Yamiche, how likely is it right now that President Biden at some point wins passage of that bigger transformational social change that he's been talking about related to infrastructure? What are the odds of that?
Well, as I was listening to Scott detail all of the different things that are going into why there it's probably going to be this vote next week, I was hearing the voice of White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki saying, if we had the votes, there would be a vote. So what you have there is the White House saying, look, we want this to happen. We're confident that the president's vision is a vision that Democrats want to get behind, this idea of seeing infrastructure as helping communities, as helping children and families. But it was very clear from all the conversations that I've been having with White House officials all week that they don't have the votes yet. And that it's going to come down to whether or not they can really get a Democratic Party that has different priorities, that has big personalities, that has a very tight majority in both houses, whether or not they can get lawmakers all on the same page to back this big transformational change. The president absolutely wants this to happen. He feels like it's part of his legacy. In talking to people who are close to him and in White House aides, they see this as part of his sort of FDR, LBJ, Eisenhower moment, where he can say, here are all of the different things that I helped the American people with during a pandemic. But it's still not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Scott, just briefly before we move on to the next topic, you mentioned that we haven't seen the details of this yet. We don't know what it looks like exactly. I mean, what's going to happen between now and Wednesday? Will we see those things before the vote happens?
Well, the top negotiators right now, the bipartisan negotiators, Rob Portman of Ohio, the Republican, and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, the Democrat, along with a number of other well-known senators, are trying to keep this bipartisan deal, this fragile deal, together. And so they're working the phones. They're talking to the White House. They're talking to counterparts even in the House and their leadership in trying to make sure that they can stay together in order to reveal some legislation so that the budget office can actually score it and see what exactly the economic impact of this infrastructure package will look like.
Sounds like some late nights. All right, just briefly want to touch on voting rights. Ohio Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus, and eight other activists were arrested on Capitol Hill yesterday during a protest on voting rights. Let's listen to some tape.
Black women, free to vote! Black women, free to vote! Black women, free to vote!
This was the week that Texas Democrats met with lawmakers on Capitol Hill after they left their state to try to stop the Republicans from passing voting restrictions there in Austin. What do you think, Yamiche? Are Democrats moving the needle at all on this issue?
I mean, what an extraordinary week, an extraordinary move for Democrats. It's It to me underscores that Democrats are feeling as though they don't have a real strategy to push back against Republicans who are moving with such efficiency in state after state to pass these laws, to introduce these laws, to restrict voting, to change the way Americans vote. We see these Texas Democrats really at their wits' end saying, okay, all we can do is not show up so that we can deny this quorum. I don't know what that means for the greater strategy. When I talk to White House officials, they say the president is going to be continuing to engage and they're going to continue to try to push to get something passed in Congress, which doesn't seem likely and seems less likely as time goes on and we get closer and closer to the midterms. But it's a real challenge for Democrats. The president gave this passionate speech saying that this is something that's as big as an issue as what caused the Civil War. But what actually that turns into in terms of strategy is hard, because when I talk to civil rights leaders, they say they want to see more urgency and more action from Democrats, but it's just not clear what that action is going to be.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it there. Yamiche Alcindor is White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, and she's the moderator of Washington Week. And Scott Wong is senior staff writer for The Hill.
Haiti received its first shipment of COVID-19 vaccines on Wednesday. The United States donated 500,000 doses from Moderna. But can the first shots be administered with Haiti still in the grips of political turmoil after the assassination of the country's president? Let's hear what Dr. Mark Augustin says about that. He is medical director of the St. Luke's nonprofit hospital in Port-au-Prince. Dr. Augustin, welcome.
Yes, it's my pleasure to be available for you.
I want to ask you about the campaign to get Haitians vaccinated. It hasn't even really started yet. The first shipments just arrived this week. You know, in some countries like the United States, more than half the population is already protected. I just wonder how that strikes you.
That's really wonderful news, and we hope that it will for sure announce some more international support, because we really in need on starting this vaccination program regarding the current surge of COVID in Haiti for now.
Do you think that the government, considering the state it's in after this assassination, will be capable of getting those shots into people's arms?
That's a great challenge, because the situation is very uneasy. And already before, there's a need for better communication campaign to welcome the vaccination, because a lot of people are still against this vaccination program. But the good news, at least, we are starting to welcome vaccination in the country. And for sure, the healthcare system, we will support for this ongoing campaign to start at least the vaccination.
What's the plan for your hospital? How will you help people get vaccinated?
So we will partner, if needed, with the government to start vaccination site. And we will offer, if needed, a place to start vaccination campaign.
But what are the conditions inside your hospital? Because if you're just now getting the vaccine, does that mean you're also struggling to get protective equipment or oxygen, ventilators, that sort of thing?
In Haiti, it's all about limited resources. So we have to import liquid oxygen from other countries and then from a plant to get it to the tanks. You can't reach the plant to get access to refill the oxygen tanks on a daily basis because of the shooting and all of this. As for protective equipment, thank God we still have some in stock, and it's not really an issue. But the real issue for COVID care in Haiti, it's really getting the oxygen to the patients, because it's not produced on site.
Well, considering the political and social turmoil there right now, how concerned are you about not being able to contain this virus and its latest surge under these conditions?
We are very, very concerned, because, as I mentioned before, because of the security issue, even at the hospital, we can hear the shot for the gang violence. So we are really living in fear. We have staff coming and spending a week at the hospital because they can't get back safely in their neighborhood. We also think the violence is preventing some patients coming at the hospital because of the ongoing violence all over the metropolitan area. this is a major concern that probably violence will disrupt the care.
So then what's your message to the rest of the world? Because the whole world right now is watching your country. What do you want to say to countries that have the resources that Haiti does not, to countries that have access to vaccines in a way that Haiti does not?
I really want to say to this country, having access to all the resources, just to look at the situation in Haiti and to share doses of vaccination to support the Haitian government to at least start this campaign, because right now this is, I think, the only hope to slow down the COVID in Haiti and to prevent future surges. And also for the very few COVID centers available, we don't have access to antivirals. So all this could really help the situation, but mostly the vaccination. We're really, really desperate to start the vaccination and to get this population vaccinated, because we don't know what would happen next.
Doctor, you are on the front lines working inside the hospital there in Port-au-Prince. Have you been vaccinated yet?
Hopefully I did get my vaccination started in the U.S., but this is not the situation of the 200 Saint-Luc workers working under COVID. So we hope next week we will get to the first shipment of the Moderna, and so we can get all the staff vaccinated.
Well, we are also hopeful that that will happen. Dr. Mark Augustin, Medical Director of the St. Luke's Nonprofit Hospital in Port-au-Prince, thank you, and we wish you and your staff all the best.
Thank you.
A lot of classic and important high school experiences were lost last year because of the pandemic. Graduations, proms, musicals. But one school in upstate New York reclaimed a show they thought was gone for good. North Country Public Radio's Amy Feiereisel has the story.
Last March, a group of kids at New York's Chateauguay Central School were pulling on their costumes and warming up their voices. It was the final dress rehearsal before they'd start performing The Addams Family, their spring musical. They'd been practicing for months. Then their director walked in and told them that due to COVID-19, the show was canceled.
The mood after that was just so, like, it went from probably the highest I've seen this group of people to the lowest.
That's Kyle Jaguar. He was a senior then. So was Douglas Cook.
Yeah, a lot of tears were shed that day. A lot of people had put in a lot of work. That's like months of work that just disappears.
The kids moved on as best they could. But it was really hard to do that, says Tilly Brialt, an English teacher and one of the three co-directors. She couldn't stop thinking about their seniors.
I cried and I cried. Knowing that they graduated and never got to put this show on was heartbreaking.
The musical theater program also lost about $8,000 because it was never able to sell tickets and refreshments. Then, just a few months ago, the state eased restrictions on outdoor school activities. The directors had an idea. What if they performed the show outside as a fundraiser?
I think we all got texts from Mrs. Brielle asking us if we'd be willing to be in the show again.
That's Aiden Tam. He's 19, and he graduated last year.
Not really expecting to go back to high school and do things that you missed out on. So obviously it's really exciting to be back here.
Most of the cast was able to come back, including four graduated seniors. A month and about 15 rehearsals later, it's the day of the show, and the cast is doing a sound check.
Is everybody listening?
They're in the middle of the Chateauguay Central School parking lot. It is sunny and very hot. The kids are having a ball.
Oh, Pugsley, ever since I met him, I just want to laugh and cry, and everything seems right and wrong at the same time.
And I reached deep into my reservoir of womanly compassion and bathed your father in forgiveness.
Okay, that's pretty good.
There are set pieces scattered around the parking lot, a makeshift stage, a big moon made out of plywood to the right, and then a sort of dungeony-like room on the left.
And quit whining about your sister. Start thinking about you and how you're going to live your life.
sound check complete, they start running some of the big numbers. Brady Spaulding is another returning senior. He plays Gomez Adams, the father of the family. He hams it up in the opening number.
The intoxicating smell of the graveyard.
Heather Lachlan, the choreographer, is facing the stage, helping the cast remember the right dance moves. And as the kids sing, music director Dale Briault is grinning ear to ear, pointing to specific kids, directing crescendos. It's been a lot of work to get here.
They were truly remarkable in terms of how much they remembered from 15, 16 months ago. So it's just been really fun to watch everything come back to life.
That's the way when you're in heaven.
And it does come back to life. More than 200 people come to watch the show as the sun sets. The fundraiser silent auction is a big hit, and people are generous with donations. They hoped they'd raise $8,000 to break even. They took in twice that amount.
You do what Adams always do.
For the kids, it was a chance to dance and sing their hearts out, and to close a chapter on their lives in a way they weren't expecting to. I asked two of the younger cast members, Kayla Spaulding and Elia Simonson, both 15, what coming back to the Adams family felt like.
It's been odd. It really has been odd. Especially since it's the same thing. It almost feels like we're going back in time. It feels like 2019 all over again.
It almost feels like you've just, like, wound back the clock. The last year and a half didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Which I would like to imagine that it didn't.
Personally, I think it's been also really weird, but it's also so relieving because I thought we weren't going to go back to this musical. And I'm so happy and just amazed that we could throw this together and how much this musical has meant to every one of us. I love how we're just kind of one big family in this cast, and it's just beautiful.
It means a lot to all of us to be here.
In Chateauguay, New York, on a beautiful summer night, they got back a day from a year and a half ago. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Feiereisel.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Demand for energy around the globe is coming back after it fell during the pandemic. The International Energy Agency said yesterday that electricity demand is set to outpace growth in renewable energy this year. Also worth noting, the growing use of coal is threatening efforts to reach net zero carbon emissions in 2050. Why don't we bring in Robin Farzad? He's host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, welcome back.
Peter, how are you?
Pretty good, thanks. So the IEA said global electricity demand is going to jump by 5% this year and then next year by 4%, which actually doesn't seem like a lot, especially after it fell during the pandemic. But how do you read into this?
It doesn't seem like a lot when global demand fell by just 1% in pandemic 2020. As economies develop, China, for example, it's lifted a record number of people out of poverty over a few decades. Consumers demand cars, washing machines, air conditioners. There's petroleum overwhelmingly for transport, and then there's power generation. Renewables such as solar, wind, they've made enormous strides over 10 years, but not nearly enough, as you see in this report, to keep up with demand growth in a way that will curtail carbon emissions. We're not just supposed to keep what we have now. We need to put a serious dent into the trajectory.
So why is the use of coal going up?
Natural gas is the less carbon-intensive industry standard here and in Europe. But in developing economies, coal, I mean, this is the rock that drove the Industrial Revolution. It's still the choice of least resistance and lowest cost for power generation. It's resilient. It's a plentiful commodity, cheap if you don't consider the many side effects. So the IEA expects coal-fired electricity generation to rise by almost 5% this year and another 3% next year, after having declined by 4% last year. We thought we were starting a terminal decline, but worryingly, it might have just been a head fake.
Some steps forward, some back. And despite the progress that the globe has had converting to clean energy, experts are saying that we are now not on pace to reach net zero emissions by 2050. How far behind are we?
To begin with, the report notes you have to stage 3/4 of emissions reductions between 2020 and 2025 in the power sector, where emissions must decline by 4.5% per year on average, led by coal-fired electricity generation falling by more than 6% a year. The trajectory is alarming because this report, as you noted, it said that coal-fired electricity generation is on track to reach an all-time high by next year.
Well, Europe is trying here. Earlier this week, the EU announced that it had this sweeping new plan to cut emissions by 55% over the next decade or so. What's the plan for getting there?
I think the big pillars include making at least 39% of all energy renewable by the end of the decade, to build out a robust carbon market for buildings and for road transportation, and to eliminate gasoline vehicles by the year 2035.
And just, you know, briefly, did what we heard from the IEA, does that throw a wrench into Europe's plan?
You know, I think if anything, it ups the bar for the U.S., China, and the developing world. I mean, Europe is world-leadingly ambitious. Soon these efforts are going to be less about austerity and self-deprivation and more about being at the cutting edge of technology and efficiency. You know, Peter, I keep coming back to Tesla. It's driving a revolutionary shift away from the internal combustion engine, not so much because it's nice and green like an old Geo Metro, but because it's the industry standard for how to build a smart car. And legacy automakers don't want to become the BlackBerry to its iPhone. So you're going to see similar competition in construction, agriculture, everything that involves carbon intensity.
Robin Farzad, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Late last month, I traveled to the Lorain County Fairgrounds in Ohio for former President Trump's first rally since the January 6 insurrection at the Capitol. As I walked through the parking area at 6 a.m., you could feel the presence of the conspiracy group QAnon at the rally site.
We're out in the field where cars are parking. There's a banner over there on top of an old school bus that says, Q sent me. Lots of derogatory things about President Biden.
A number of those I spoke with that day were indeed QAnon followers. And something I heard over and over from them, they fully expect Trump to be back in the White House by August. Let's bring in Ben Collins. He covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. Welcome back to Here and Now, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with that belief on the part of many QAnon members that Trump is somehow going to be reinstated as president, not when there's another election, but next month. At that rally, I spoke to one attendee. Her name was Kathleen Free. She was there very early in the morning, hours before the gates opened, having driven more than 5 hours from Fort Knox, Kentucky to Ohio just to see Trump. Let's listen.
I'm ready for him to come back. I think our election was stolen. You know, I think Biden and them cheated, and it's coming out.
On the way in, we passed some signs that said Trump 2024.
No, he needs to come back now. We won't have a country in 2024 if we leave it up to Biden.
I should also say that opinion was not an outlier. I heard it over and over as I worked the crowd that day. Ben, just react to that.
Yeah, it's a very common belief among Trump supporters right now. And by the way, it's not just far-right QAnon supporters. It's people who watch Newsmax in OAN and have a different algorithmic set on the internet than most people do. And they believe this because they have been told since January by places like the Gateway Pundit, which is a huge driver of news on the pro-Trump internet, that these election audits that are not real, they are conducted by QAnon supporters, will eventually overturn the election, that it'll start in Arizona, and that then eventually it'll happen in Pennsylvania, and then Georgia, and it'll have a domino effect. And they believe this will happen basically overnight. And some of them have more fantastical beliefs. For example, Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, believes that there will be some sort of Supreme Court case that all 9 justices, both left and right, will overnight overturn the election and somehow reinstall Donald Trump as the president. So this is not a far-fetched belief to people on the pro-Trump internet. They have a whole game plan. They believe various different versions of this game plan. One involves Donald Trump being installed as Speaker of the House somehow in the next couple of months. Mm-hmm. But regardless, one way or another, they believe that he's going to be back in office through some means that would have to be, by law, extrajudicial.
There was a recent article in Politico about how Trump's team is trying to actually distance itself a bit from QAnon. Trump hasn't acknowledged the group except to tell NBC's Savannah Guthrie last year that he heard they didn't like pedophiles. Even Kathleen Free told me she was sure, though, that Trump knew about QAnon. Do we have a sense of how much of Trump's base, though, is tied into the QAnon conspiracy theory?
The polling on this is sort of all over the place. QAnon support ranges from hundreds of thousands to tens of billions of people, depending on the poll that you see. And it also depends on if people are subscribing to QAnon outright. A lot of QAnon supporters say that they don't believe in QAnon. QAnon isn't real. But that's a talking point from Q, the guy who is the alleged secret government insider at the center of QAnon. So it's really hard to pin this down. You know, the reality is, unfortunately, a lot of the Q movement's biggest talking points, that there's a cabal taking over the world, that they're trying to get you injected with shots, that there's no such thing as a fair election, that this cabal is doing some sort of wide-scale sex trafficking operation, and that the center of it is Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. That is seeped deeply into what a lot of people in the Republican Party now just believe. Just because it's not called QAnon anymore doesn't mean it's not prevalent. Probably means it's more prevalent than ever.
Okay, well, I wanted to ask about the Republican Party. The national GOP just feels like an extension of Donald Trump at this point. But is QAnon showing up within the party, maybe just more on the local level?
Yeah, what we've seen is direct orders from QAnon message boards and influencers to run for office. For example, Mike Flynn, who is probably the largest influencer in the QAnon community who isn't Q and who isn't Donald Trump.
Let me stop you there quickly. This is Mike Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's extremely close to Donald Trump. But he said a few weeks ago, take responsibility for your school committees or boards, get involved in the education of our children, and run for local, state, or federal office. Basically, what he's saying is stop waiting for some sort of plan to happen and take it into your own hands. And that message is at the top of QAnon message boards. That's what they've said for a while now, is don't call it QAnon. Don't go in there and say, hey, I'm a QAnon believer, and by the way, vote for me. They're saying, just go to your local school board, get involved. If you can, get elected. Sometimes it takes hundreds of votes to get elected at the local level. And then once you're in there, try to plant the seeds of the conspiracy that we all believe.
You mentioned school boards. The National Education Association, the big teachers union, is warning that conspiracy theorists are running for and in some cases winning these local elections, as you describe. I mean, how prevalent really, though, is this across the country? Obviously, it's prompted the NEA to issue that statement.
Look, it's hard to know how prevalent it is, but we've seen it on YouTube videos across the country. Look, in Michigan, there was a woman who said, who tweeted that, you know, QAnon had been confirmed, who was now on a school board, and people didn't realize until it was too late, and they're trying to recall her, but it takes months to do so. You know, we've heard from people all throughout the country, from, you know, California to Michigan to Florida, that these people are trying to run. Sometimes it's really obvious that they're QAnon supporters, even if they don't say it out loud, so people are kind of sniffing that out and not voting for them and getting the word out. But it's, you know, it's impossible to know, frankly. That's part of the thing. You know, QAnon supporters do this thing they call digital camouflage. They used to be afraid of getting banned from Facebook or Twitter, because if you talked about QAnon outright on Facebook or Twitter last year, you would just get banned. So they come up with different words, different codes. You know, they call him 17, because Q is the 17th letter of the alphabet, for example. And they publicly disavow support for QAnon. But once again, all of the talking points are there. And it doesn't take a genius to figure it out.
And are they running on specific policy positions when they are trying to get on a local school board somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, for example, there was this guy in Florida who went up there and he was talking about how, you know, masks were secret covers for trafficking operations, because human traffickers, their big thing is they love masks. Now, this isn't true if you talk to anti-human trafficking operations. So it sounds fantastical instantly when you hear these people talk at these meetings. They talk of elaborate government or worldwide plots to take over the world, or, you know, how, like, the virus was made in a lab, and not only that it was made in the lab, but it was made by the United States government, right? That sort of conspiracy thinking pervades in this space, and it comes out very readily and clearly in these school board meetings.
Again, I heard over and over that Q followers think Trump will be back in office in August. What happens when that doesn't happen?
Look, they are getting very used to the fact that every doomsday they have comes and goes and nothing takes place. This is how cults work. This is how they operate. They keep pushing the date back because it's based on anticipation. It's based on the idea that you could wake up one day and all your dreams get solved, all of your political enemies get tossed aside. So they will just keep pushing the date back, and they will find little things to cling to, little bits of hope. Some Q influencers are saying, don't wait, it's not going to happen in August. This stuff doesn't happen overnight, of course, but it will happen soon. You can already start to see that narrative start to shift. Look, some people have already gotten too upset and can't wait. There have been people from the very beginning of this conspiracy theory who have, you know, blocked roads and committed violent action because they've been told that all of the missing children are somewhere and they need to be stopped. Along the way, there are lots of lone wolves in this space that can't wait anymore. That's really the worry. But until then, most people will just keep pushing the date back.
That's Ben Collins, who covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
An update on a story we brought you last month about LGBTQ athletes from around the world vying to make history by qualifying for the Olympics. With a week to go before the game's opening ceremony in Tokyo, the list is expansive. A record number of out athletes are set to compete. Sid Ziegler is a sports writer and co-founder of Out Sports. It's a news outlet that focuses on LGBTQ issues in sports. He's been keeping score. Sid, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, first of all, up until these games, no openly transgender athlete had ever competed at the Olympics. So how much will the landscape change when those games open next week in Tokyo?
Well, there are three athletes going to Tokyo that we know of. Chelsea Wolfe is part of Team USA. She's a BMX freestyler. She's a reserve athlete. So Chelsea's only going to compete if one of the two Americans can't compete. Quinn is a transgender non-binary soccer player who's going to compete on the women's Canadian soccer team. But the one that's really going to get the headlines is Laurel Hubbard, a transgender weightlifter who's competing for New Zealand. In the past, Laurel has won a couple of medals at world championships, never a gold, but she's the one people are really talking about.
And what's the conversation been about how or if transgender athletes should be competing in the Olympics?
Well, of course, you have a lot of people who see this large woman and say that it's unfair that she's competing. But a couple things that I want to point to. Number one, weightlifting is by weight class. So Laurel is competing against the largest size women. It's not as though she's competing against women who are 100 pounds trying to lift weight. The other part is that Laurel has far and away exceeded the regulations that the International Olympic Committee has put in for transgender athletes, which requires a period of time where you have to transition, your hormones have to kind of match more of what a cisgender woman's hormones would look like, particularly testosterone. Mm-hmm. And Laurel has done that for many times the length of period that they require. So she has far exceeded the IOC's requirements to compete.
More broadly, you've been keeping track at OutSports of all the athletes who identify as LGBTQ going into these Olympics. You knew that it would likely be a record number, and it was. Tell us about that. How many are we talking about here?
Our list now stands at 142 publicly out LGBTQ athletes who are all headed to Tokyo. That is more than the number of publicly out athletes at every single Olympic Games before it combined. In wow. Rio, we only knew of 56, and that was by far a record. And we know of many more who we are going to be adding next week. One of the interesting dynamics is that of the 142, only 15 are men. 127 of them are women. And I think that says a lot about where men's and women's sports are in relation to athletes feeling comfortable coming out and how many LGBTQ athletes are in those sports.
Well, and we'll see if that changes over the next couple of years. We have seen some high-profile examples of men coming out in sports. But what a difference a few years makes, right? Why do you think there are so many more?
One of the reasons is social media. They are just living their lives openly on Instagram, and that's how we've found a lot of them. And, you know, I think that there are just more LGBTQ women in elite-level sports. We just had an article today about 8 women just on the Dutch soccer team. I don't think there are many men's soccer teams that are half the team or more are LGBTQ.
Right. One thing we're noting is that the country of Japan is not planning to send any openly gay Olympians to these games. What's the landscape like there for the host country and for that community there, and how are activists feeling in Japan?
It's tough. A lot of times places are selected to host these large-scale events where LGBTQ people do not have the freedom that they have in the United States or Canada. There was a lot of hope that the visibility of the games and the importance of inclusion to the games might drive some legislation to fight against discrimination and empower the LGBTQ community, and that has been routinely stopped at the federal level in Japan, even over the last few months. So we were hoping for more advancement. We didn't get it, but that doesn't mean that the legacy of the Olympics can't have a positive impact on the LGBTQ community in Japan.
Right, and to that point, I wonder how this moment in history feels to you. I know you have been reporting on this issue for more than 2 decades, and here we are on the cusp of history with these games.
You know, we had Carl Nassib, an NFL player with the Las Vegas Raiders, come out publicly last month to have this tsunami, this tidal wave of out athletes at the Tokyo Olympics. Just, it's a number that I didn't fathom. There's an athlete representing a Caribbean country and South American. You know, it's not just North America and Western Europe. It's all over the world. And that's really great to see.
Sid Ziegler, a sports writer and co-founder of OutSports. It's a news outlet that focuses on LGBTQ issues in sports. Hey, Sid, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Don Gagne. It's Here and Now.